about the ninth precept, which admonishes us not to be angry or have ill will. So don't be angry. In Buddhism and in so-called enlightened Western culture, we condemn anger. We warn each other and ourselves against anger. We fear anger. We avoid situations in which anger might come up for us or from somebody else. And we can even get into the habit of denying we feel anger. Why is this? We shun anger because of what it can drive us to do. Shout, curse, say things we never would say otherwise, even hit and injure a person or object we're angry at. So it's what we do when anger arises that's the problem, not the emotion of anger in itself. But rather than scolding us not to be angry, in the mind of Clover, Aiken Roshi quite gently advises us, don't indulge in anger. Don't indulge in anger. What is indulging in anger? It's yelling and cursing and hitting and harming. Or it's castigating oneself for feeling angry. Or it's going so far as to become depressed rather than to feel angry. Not indulging does not mean never feel anger and always suppress it, always deny that you feel it, choose depression instead of it. After all, anger is a human emotion, equal in status, though not in kind, with other strong emotions we humans feel, such as love, joy, fear, grief. Anger is in the human repertoire. If we were never to feel angry, we'd lose some of our humanness. So not indulging in anger doesn't mean don't ever feel or be angry. It simply means don't act on these feelings of anger when they arise. So following Aiken Roshi's advice not to indulge in our anger, we work on ourselves, and eventually we get ourselves under enough control so that we only slam doors, or we only clam up, or some other ineffective behavior that telegraphs our anger, but at least it doesn't physically or emotionally or verbally harm somebody. But we've still got this anger inside of us, and it is leaking out to those around us, whether we know it or not. The anger may feel boiling hot. It may feel steely cold. Whatever its temperature, we really need to deal with it somehow. To that end, Aiken Roshi quotes Thich Nhat Hanh, who encourages us to become well acquainted with our anger, to respect it, to treat it tenderly, for it too is Buddha. Thich Nhat Hanh says, treat your anger with the utmost respect and tenderness, for it is no other than yourself. Do not suppress it. Simply be aware of it. Awareness is like the sun. When it shines on things, they are transformed. When you are aware that you are angry, your anger is transformed. Angry behavior, I think, is an attempt to have control or regain control or agency over our experience and circumstances. My younger son, I can remember, used to stay out and play till just dinner time, not quite, he'd be late or something like that. So when he would come in, sometimes I would be really worried about him and I would say, "Where have you been? You're late," with an ugly face. I was expressing my anger. Or my husband had a bad day at work and he came home and the next door neighbor's big dog was barking really loud, so we would open the window and shout an obscenity at the dog. So neither of these things is a terribly harmful to others, but it isn't very happy either. We need to learn how to express our anger in unharmful ways. Our angry behavior says, "What about me? I'm here too, I matter." But we need to somehow convey that more gently. So let's look at a few of the perhaps many varieties of anger. There is righteous anger, such as what one feels when someone, yourself, or someone else is treated unfairly or unjustly, or when the environment is treated unfairly and is degraded, or some institution causes harm to a whole class of people. There are plenty of things these days to feel righteous anger about and to express it. And there are many actually quite reasonable ways to, and productive ways to express it. And we can learn those ways and practice the skills for effectively expressing our righteous anger in the world. Then there is ill will type of anger, perhaps a kind of habitual reaction to events or people based on our judgment or prejudgment of others. Something in our experience has led us to feel resentment or suspicion or skepticism toward another. Ill will may be a more cognitively driven mental formation. It's our attitude about certain classes of experience or people. It may be kind of subtle and pervasive feeling, and thereby we're so used to it that we may not even notice it. Maybe it's more difficult for us to detect just because it's so pervasive in us. For example, I often turn off the radio when I know, when I hear a person that I disagree with, a politician, is going to speak. I just turn it off so I don't have to listen to that and get ill will. Well, I'm experiencing ill will at that moment. And one of the things I've been upset about in recent weeks and months has been the gun control issue. And I heard somebody say on the radio that gun owners have positive experiences with guns, and people who aren't gun owners have the opposite, have really negative experiences with them, negative associations with them, and I have those. So I realized, well, maybe I need to find out what it's like to be a person who's pro-gun and why they like it. So I read a book recently about it called Gun Guys, and this man and journalist went around the U.S. for about a year talking to people about why they like their guns and experiencing that and so forth, and he himself is a gun owner. So I got a lot of insight into what's going on with those people and got sort of motivated to try and think, well, how could I include them in trying to create a solution rather than just fighting them and pushing them away using my anger. So I got over my ill will there, but I've got plenty of other opportunities for ill will, I can assure you. And it's a rather unhappy state of mind to be in, so I really don't want to be that. It's a drag on my mental and emotional life. Not to speak of how it separates me from others. Ill will is, you know, against that person out there, so I'm separate, and we're separate, and he's separate. So I have been, and I continue to do, to study my daily life for instances of ill will, and it pops up pretty frequently, as I've said. But over time, through mindfulness, I can investigate it and begin to let it go and not feel it as often or as strongly. Then there's a third kind of anger that I've experienced, and that's a really deeply or highly emotional type of anger that suddenly arises. It may be kind of explosive. It could be even as intense as rage. It doesn't happen to me very often, but I've certainly had that experience in my lifetime. This could also be a kind of cold, condemning type of anger that is so ingrained in a person that the person is not open at all to any reason or argument. This emotional type of anger can be more troublesome than the first two, ill will and righteous anger, because it arises perhaps entirely from the unconscious. It's suddenly there. May not occur very often, but if we're not prone to aggression toward others, it may not lead to any physical violence, but it can scare or dismay people who witness it or are the subject of it. So although this kind of anger is the type we'd like to deny we ever feel or express because it's so unwholesome, it is the type we really must get to know. As with all negative emotions, the way to reduce or eliminate deep anger is not pretending like we don't feel it, not by suppressing it or denying it or blaming ourselves for it. The way to stop this deep anger is to become intimate with it, to study it thoroughly in all of its manifestations. We must ask, in what circumstances, under what conditions, does this anger arise in me? As I have pondered instances of this deep type of anger in myself, I've discovered that it occurs almost exclusively in relationships that are of great importance to me, my close relationships, because I have a big stake in that. If something is conflict there, that can raise some real deep emotions in me. Some people get really angry when things break, their car or their computer or the toilet. I get frustrated, but I don't get really angry about those things. But I do, anger can occur with me in relationships that are important to me. So I study the instances in my closer relationships in which anger has arisen in the past. And what am I studying when I study this anger? What it feels like, where it is I feel it in my body, what goes off in my head when it's happening. You've heard the saying, seeing red. That's what anger is for some people, is seeing red. I'm actually probably blood engorging your brain or your eyes or something like that. And so almost literally you see the color red. That doesn't happen so much for me. But what happens to me, has happened to me on numbers of occasions when I've suddenly become angry, is I get into physical motion immediately. And I've had some kind of laughable experiences with that. I'm not hitting anybody or yelling at them or anything like that, but I'm just whirling around. And one time I remember quite a long time ago, I had a carton, a half-gallon carton of milk in my hand when I suddenly hit my anger over whatever was happening. I don't remember what it was. So I just threw milk all over the kitchen, and I knew I was the one who had to clean it up. And I don't know if you've had to clean up milk before, but it's real hard to get out of cracks in the linoleum and so forth. And I knew that was going to happen, but I had to express it in a non-harmful way to anyone else, at least. But what's driving this kind of anger in me? Anger, psychologists have observed, is a cover-up, really, for a prior emotion that is even less tolerable to us than the anger itself. This might be fear or hurt or guilt or any number of difficult emotions that we have. Anger has a lot of energy in it, like whirling around with milk, throwing it all over the kitchen. So we use the energy, and it gives us a sense of a little bit more control over what's happening. Of course, it isn't real, but it gives us that illusion. So when experiencing a prior, less tolerable emotion, we quickly default to anger, and we feel at least a little bit better. I've discovered that for me, one catalyzing emotion for anger is shame. Shame that I feel when I believe I have done something that makes me look really bad, stupid, inappropriate, imperfect to someone that matters to me. This doesn't always happen, but it can be the thing that's really driving the anger. So now shame becomes the thing that I want to investigate and see why that happens, under what circumstances. Whereas anger can manifest itself in seeing red, for me, shame that follows, that the anger follows, manifests in my body like a black drapery dropping over my entire body. It's a terrible feeling of worthlessness, the exposed worthlessness of myself, my ego, that tells me I am separate from others and unworthy. An example from quite distant past, about 35 years ago. It's a time of a time when I felt shame because, and followed it by anger very quickly, was 35 years ago when my husband and I were going through a difficult divorce. And on the week of the divorce court trial that we were to go to, his lawyer called me up, and he was a very clever guy, and he shouldn't have been calling me. That was kind of out of bounds, but he did, and I think he was trying to see how he could, you know, manipulate me a bit to get some information for how to treat me in court. So I was really nervous during this conversation, and during it, he said some word. He used a word that I didn't understand, didn't know the meaning of, and my reply to him was that showed that I didn't understand what he said, and he laughed at me. And when I got off the phone, I was so incensed that I kicked the door, and I sprained my big toe really badly. So I had to physically react to that. You know, went from shame to anger and more control, but also a hurting toe. So that's a way that I can react when I get really upset and angry. So in my case, yours is going to be different. When I felt acutely ashamed, I defaulted immediately to anger to dispel the unbearable discomfort of shame. So trying to understand my anger, I ask, when and why do I feel shame? And I answer, when I am shown or revealed to be imperfect to people who are, for one reason or another, critical to my well-being, such as my husband's lawyer who could get something on me and say something to me in court that would be jeopardizing for me. Of course, I know rationally that I'm not perfect. I know it's really obvious that I'm not perfect, but inside, deep inside myself, my ego wants to pretend that I still am. The Lojong saying, drive all blames into one, is a really good slogan to remind me of what's happening with me when I get upset and angry. Drive all blames into one. This is the visual. So what is the who or what is the one that we're driving all blames into? Our sense, our illusion, that we are a self that's that needs to be perpetuated, that can be perpetuated, that is continuous, and so forth. That's our mistake, is that we're defending our self, which really doesn't exist ongoing. So the one to blame when some difficulty happens, like talking to a lawyer or whatever happens when you get upset and angry, is it's really what's going on with me and my ego and my sense of self. It's not my husband's lawyer that caused my anger. It's my misunderstanding or illusion that I have a self to protect and perpetuate in its perfection. And when I get to this insight, all the air hisses out of my anger, and I'm done emoting. I may not have words for the situation, but I'm done, quiet. So to follow and practice the precept of not indulging in anger, we must study ourselves, our body, and our sensations and thoughts when anger or ill will arises. We must look underneath our anger to what drives it. And once we get a handle on the prior emotion and see that it is connected with our bedrock assumption that we have a self we must protect and perpetuate, our case for being angry begins to dissolve and fall away. Buddhism teaches us that everything is always changing, including ourselves. If this is so, then there is nothing to defend or perpetuate, is there? We can let go of the anger, let go of the shame or the fear or the hurt or whatever drives the anger, and just be aware of what is. A clever lawyer who gets a rise out of me, nothing more. Unpleasant, yes. Cause for rage, no. Meanwhile, of course, we're also practicing this precept of not indulging in anger by not attacking anyone verbally, or certainly not physically, not shouting or hitting or cursing or slamming doors or whatever is our usual way of manifesting anger. We're training ourselves not to do those outward expressions. And we are not harming ourselves by going off on the tangent of being angry when the real problem is something else, like shame or fear, embarrassment, whatever. We can remember that being human includes feeling anger. And we can begin to follow Thich Nhat Hanh's advice about anger. In one of his precepts, he states them somewhat differently than we have been doing, but in his he says, do not maintain anger or hatred. Do not maintain anger, so don't let it go on and on. Learn to penetrate and transform them when they are still seeds in your consciousness. So when you get a chance to see that, focus on it. As soon as these arise, anger or hatred, turn your attention to your breath in order to see and understand the nature of your anger and hatred and the nature of persons who have caused your anger and hatred. This is from his 14 precepts of the order of interbeing. And then he also says in a different place in Tricycle magazine, this is quoted, the seeds of anger are always there. When you notice, when you keep alive your understanding, they have no chance to manifest. Understanding something that stays with you and practicing the precepts, practicing meditation, helps you deepen your understanding all the time. So we need to study ourselves and study what makes us angry, what it might be connected to, what it might be masking. We need, that's one thing, is self-investigation. The other thing is get our reactiveness, our expression of anger, whether through voice or physical body or whatever, get that under better control. But then eventually, we can get to the point of just noticing and observing. And when it comes up, honor ourselves by acknowledging it, but we'll get to the point where we don't have to act, I think. We really are in zazen in all circumstances, and I think that's a wonderful thing to aim at and to return to if we slip up from time.